You are listening to Believe, Strive, Achieve, Endurance Podcast with Diogo Custodio. If this is your first time listening, then thanks so much for coming. Get ready and enjoy the show.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Believe, Strive, Achieve, Endurance Podcast. My name is Diogo. Today I'm with Coach Phil, who is bringing a very interesting guest. Philip, how are you, first of all?
Hi Diogo, how are you?
I'm very good.
I'm good, yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for asking.
So Philip, who do we have with us today?
So today I'm bringing a swimmer who I used to work with. They were part of our swimming squad here in Abingdon, and they moved away from the area. So I hope that wasn't to do with the swim squad that we had, but they moved location to the South Coast for work. And throughout, I guess, that period, but a bit before and then definitely afterwards, they were going through a real transition from coming from a running background, marathons and sort of longer distance things like that, into swimming. In fact, very much distance swimming. So this athlete has done some incredible race distances. They've done the channel as part of a relay. They're looking at doing the channel as a soloist in the, I think, next summer. And also swam the length of Loch Ness, or Lake Ness, if you're not Scottish at all, up in Scotland, and some other brilliant sort of 10-mile swims as well around the UK, and other lake swims as well. So she's a really long distance swimmer now, and it's really been fascinating to watch her journey from, if you like, that runner into long distance swimmer, and just hearing about how she's come from essentially an everyday person. You wouldn't have realized that she was going to go and do these amazing swim distances as a runner, and how she's made that transition, what she's sort of done to help her move forwards with that, and how she's really progressed again as an athlete. But the journey that she's gone on to even become to the point where she would identify as an athlete as well has been really interesting. So yeah, really, really interesting journey, which I'm looking forward to talking about with her.
She does very interesting, in fact. What do you think our listeners will learn after this conversation?
Well, I think anyone doing distance swimming, the two things which go through people's mind is, first of all, how do you deal with the cold? Because distance swimmers like that, they usually have to do it non-wetsuit. So they, for it to be kind of legitimate swim, the channel has to be non-wetsuit to count as an official swim. So there's always questions about, you know, how do you even do this sort of preparation side of things for cold? And I remember when she was here in the UK, in Abingdon, doing the swim squad stuff, throughout the year she was still going for cold water swim dips or swims in like December and Christmas time and things like that, and breaking ice, which I know you and I would have a very different reaction to the concept of let's go for a swim in December. We'd be like, yep, bath. And she's like, lake. So she's, you know, always been around that cold water environment, and I think that's going to be very interesting to explore that a little bit. And also, you know, the distance is huge. We spoke to Mark Harvey beforehand around that Decker Ironman, where he's doing significantly big distances. How you manage to comprehend what you're about to do, I think, it's always interesting about these people doing the ultra long distance sports, and how they deal with endurance, and how they compartmentalize, I guess, the endurance side of what they do, because it is longer distances even than what some other people are choosing to do as well. And then swimming, open water, you know, everybody, I mean, how many camps have we done together where someone kind of speaks to you quite quietly and says, actually, I'm really nervous about the open water, either because of the environment or because of the things that could be in the water. And so I think exploring the idea of the fear side of open water, which is true for pretty much everybody. You know, if you go for deep water, you've got all sorts of things that go on in your mind as well. So yeah, I think those areas will be particularly interesting to explore from a what can you get out of this perspective. And then there's the clear thing as well, right? This individual has gone from running to I'm going to go and swim the channel, or swim across the channel, or something along those lines. Like what changes? How does someone make those changes from being, you know, an an everyday person kind of walking down the street kind of thing to doing something which very, very few people have ever even thought about doing, and even fewer yet have achieved doing as well. So I think there's a few lessons that will come out of it, which people can take around doing something they really put their mind to it and prioritize that, because everyone has a choice and everything is a choice for people. So I think there'll be some amazing takeaways for people around that kind of area. What can it be that you as an individual can choose to do, and how can you then really flourish in it? Because that's exactly what this individual's done, and it's done it in a really impressive way. So I think it's very fascinating for anyone to look at, and hopefully lots of really good learning points for them. I guess the other thing which is really interesting for people to look at and consider with this swimmer is that piece on identity, because they were never the fastest swimmer in the squad. They were always hardworking, and the attitude was one that they were just looking to learn all the time. I remember giving her technical pointers and technical cues, and it wasn't just about delivering the technical pointers or the technical cues. It was also about, well, okay, why am I doing that? Why will that make a difference? What will be the benefits around that? And so I think if there's one thing that I can definitely, or what I definitely picked up as a coach at that moment in time, would be more around the fact that she really was a student of the sport, and she took a lot out of that, I guess, learning environment, challenging environment. As I said, she wasn't the fastest, but she was looking up to the fastest swimmers, and she'd always be the person who'd still be there doing the session, you know, the hard stuff as well. And I think that ability to be a student of the sport and really study it and understand why you're making changes and why you're making or doing certain things is really, really important and really beneficial for anybody at all. So again, some things there which would be interesting for people to take away and learn from.
I'm looking forward to it, honestly. Looks like a very interesting conversation. So we're going to talk at the end of it.
Yeah, looking forward to having this conversation too.
So see you in a minute. Bye-bye.
Hello there, and welcome to this afternoon's podcast episode. I'm here sat with Carmen Somerset, who is someone I've worked with a long time ago when she was locally in one of our swimming squads here near Abingdon. And since then, she's gone off and done some amazing things in the swimming sport rather than triathlon, but definitely in the extensively endurance range of swimming. So Carmen has completed a Lake Windermere swim, a Loch Ness swim most recently. She's crossed the channel as part of a relay of four, and she's also done the Rampion swim in Brighton as well, which was 10 miles. So she definitely, if you take swimmers, most swimmers think long distance swimming is about 400 meters. If you ask any pure swimmer, they're like, yeah, anything over 400 is long distance. That's crazy. Then you speak to a triathlete, and a sprint distance is 700 odd meters. 750, and then you speak to Carmen, and that's barely even getting wet. So Carmen, welcome to today's show, and thank you very much for coming on board.
Yeah, thank you, Philip. Thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
So let's kick this off, because you kind of came into endurance sport as a non-swimmer. So just talk to us a little bit about how you came into swimming. Like, how did you get from where you started to swimming?
Yeah, I think, it's quite interesting in a way, because I could probably say that I kind of fell into swimming. It was never necessarily my plan to do anywhere near the distances or the events that I've covered originally. So I was originally a runner for a very long time. And I suppose what is similar between my running achievements and then my swimming achievements is that it's the love for the distance. And that's something that I've been able to sort of think about and articulate in sort of recent years. But yeah, I came into kind of sport and endurance sport through running, kind of going up to marathon. And I think if I'd stayed with running, then I probably would have gone much further than that, and just sort of, you know, going to sort of, you know, ultras and, multi-stage events and that sort of stuff. But I think what kind of happened is that, yes, I was doing a lot of running and I was very much enjoying it, but I was also conscious that I needed to do something more than just run. And so where I was based at the time in Croydon, my running club also did one day a week of swimming training. So I thought, I'll give that a go, and that'll kind of tick the box of cross training. And over quite a few years, it didn't necessarily happen overnight, but I always enjoyed the swimming element and then what it, you know, the benefits it was giving me to my running. But I think over the years, I kind of allowed myself to actually sort of essentially sort of fall in love with the swimming. You know, it wasn't that I didn't enjoy the running, but I think the love for the swimming took over and there was definitely a passion there that might not have been quite there with the running as much. And yeah, I just allowed the swimming to take over and to eventually call myself a swimmer rather than the runner that swims occasionally.
Well, I think that's an interesting point because you definitely didn't start as a swimmer. You weren't swimming at kind of 2 years old onwards and kind of didn't fall into the water and start doing butterfly or IM or anything like that crazy. You know, you did come to swimming much later in life than the average swimmer. So, I mean, how did you enjoy the learning process of becoming a swimmer?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, actually, because I think that to some of the points that you've made, whilst I learned to swim as a child, my parents were very committed to well, myself and my two sisters learning how to swim from a safety point of view and also being able to enjoy the water if on holiday or, you know, going to the beach and things like that. But yeah, it was never from a competitive point of view. So I think coming into it much later as an adult and then having the opportunity to swim with some fantastic people, very good swimmers or, you know, triathletes or, you know, athletes in their own right. And, you know, I wasn't from that background. So I think it was, to be quite honest, a lot of the times it was tough. You know, you're in a pool, a space, a lake, wherever, with people who have been doing this for a very long time and who are, it comes across very, you know, very naturally good at it, probably because they've been doing it for a very long time and you're very new to it. And it's not only that you're new to the fundamentals of being able to do the sport, but also just the understanding of how to train, kit, equipment, all of that sort of stuff. It was a great unknown. I think that there were a lot of times and it probably felt very uncomfortable. But I'll give you a situation. So I think probably for most of the sessions that I had with you and the phenomenal swimmers that I had an opportunity to swim with, you know, I knew my place in the pack, if you like. I knew where I was placed in the pool. But I think you have to get comfortable with that being uncomfortable, because otherwise you're never going to get any better. You're never going to learn anything new. If you only want to put yourself in situations where you know everything, where's the growth in that? And I think that, you know, I was comfortable knowing that I didn't know that much about swimming and I was learning how to swim and learning all of the things that kind of go with not only pool swimming, but also obviously taking it to open water as well, which then is a whole nother kind of area of understanding what to do and how to do it. So in a way, it's kind of, you know, park your ego and learn and, you know, and learn from inspiring people, you know, and see that as an opportunity and not something to shy away from.
So just picking up something you said that you didn't identify as a swimmer at the beginning, it took you a long time to identify as a swimmer. There's a really great quote, which I really like, which is the athlete is the mind and the body is just the vessel. And I think that was really useful for athletes when they're injured, you know, just remember you're still athletic. But you're always obviously active, but when did you start realizing that you were an athlete?
That's a good question. I don't know if I do at the moment, actually.
Well, that's kind of where I was thinking as well. You might not yet think about that.
Yeah, but I might not. Yeah, I don't know if I'm at that. Definitely a swimmer. When did I start? To be honest with you, I think probably one of the turning points was, and I was still doing a lot of running at this point, but probably we're talking maybe 4 years ago now, might be coming up to about five. I did my first 10K event, 10K swimming event, so I'll clarify that. So I was still running quite a bit, but I was doing a lot of swimming as well. And I'd signed up for my first 10K, which at the time was a bit of an ask, but I wanted to do it and I wanted to train really well for it and really applied myself to it. So, you know, I wanted it to be a success. And I think it was kind of after that point that I thought, okay, I've swum 10K. I think now I could call myself a swimmer. I don't know. I think that part of me, like maybe why I'm kind of struggling with the words here is because I'm just doing what I love. I'm just doing what I enjoy. And I don't necessarily kind of feel like I have any great need for a title or kind of like an accolade. I'm just doing what I love. And I think, you know, feel incredibly fortunate in lots of regards to be able to do what I love. So, you know, be that athlete, be that swimmer, be that, you know, whatever I could call myself.
I think I remember in one of your comments, I think it was just after you've just completed the Channel Crossing, you said that you were very, very open about how swimming was more than just the act of moving your arms more or less efficiently through the water, but it was much more around how it made you feel. And actually, you used a line which was, swimming is you. And I wondered if you could perhaps just explain to people what you mean by that for you within swimming, and then maybe what were the things that made you realize that swimming made you feel like that, because obviously not everyone will have that same feeling for swimming, but they hopefully will find that same feeling in something else.
I remember kind of saying that, and I kind of remember where I was kind of headspace wise and experience wise when I said that. And I think it's just continued to evolve. So I think for me, and particularly some of the swims that I've done in the last couple of years, that, you know, we've gone into some pretty big distances, that feeling has just continued to evolve. So I, like you say, I very much enjoy the movement of swimming, how your body moves through the water. But then I think it's also it's how you feel in the water. I think that's probably one of my big attractions to open water, because that will feel very different to pool. But equally, it's kind of, for me, it's any body of water. But then also one of the things that I kind of found very interesting, and what's kind of ultimately attracted me to the swimming side of things, is the it really is kind of the mental aspect to it. And, you know, particularly when you're, I'd say, swimming, but I suppose you could probably say this for any endurance discipline, is that, you know, you're doing it kind of on your own. Obviously, you've got hopefully a team around you, and you've got a huge amount of support, because otherwise it probably wouldn't be possible. But ultimately, you are the only person that is riding that bike or running that marathon or swimming, you know, the in the event. So being able to be comfortable in yourself and in your mind, and getting to a point where you can be comfortable and you can deal with all of the things that come up that are probably going to want to stop you, I find that incredibly powerful. And I think that not just in terms of being able to do that on a swim, but also being able to take that into just everyday life, being able to deal with, you know, your own voices and what comes up to challenge you, you know, and having that kind of the mental resilience is something that, as I've gone through my swimming journey, I found really, really interesting, and also very helpful for everyday life.
I just wonder, as you're talking there, that were you aware of how that ability to deal with hurdles, that ability to be comfortable within your own movement, how that correlated in the sport and then outside of the sport? And if there was any correlation with that point in time, you're like, I am a swimmer now. I've just swum 10K.
I think probably it's probably taken a number of events to be able to not get used to, but in a way to continue to explore that. And I think that and I suppose even just in the, probably even in the last year or even in the last couple of years, some of the swims that I've done, it kind of then takes you into a whole different kind of space within your brain. You know, I think when you start, for me particularly, if you start getting into sort of the 5-6 hour territory and then beyond, you know, that's a different headspace to maybe if you were doing 2 hours. That being said, I've had some very, very uncomfortable 2 hours that have been very unpleasant compared to some of my 5 or 6 hours. So I think it probably just comes down to experience and a kind of an evolving to your word as an athlete or as a swimmer with those experiences.
And when you go into those sort of longer time periods, I'm going to ask you later kind of what the distances look like for each of them, because people who are in the swimming community know what Windermere is, for example, but those who aren't might not know what those distances are. But just sticking into the idea that, you know, you're swimming for 5 or 6 hours, I mean, that's about the same time as people go to work you know, once you take away lunch break and you know, a few water breaks and everything else. So, you know, how and where does your mind go? Like, what are you thinking about or not thinking about? How does that feel? How does that work?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question, actually. It's probably one of the questions that I get asked the most. What do you think about? To be perfectly honest, what's quite different from how I used to approach my runs compared to my swim is, for swimming, I never prepare about what I might think about. So, for example, when I was running, I would sometimes think, right, I've got to work out how to have that difficult conversation with someone at work, or, you know, plan dinner or whatever it might be. And I'll do that on my run tonight. I'll figure that out on my run tonight. Swimming, I never do that. I almost allow the mind to do what the mind's going to do, and then work out what I need to do to be able to kind of, I say control, but work with what I've got and work with what's happening on the swim. The way that I kind of approach it is that, and this is something that I learned a lot during my Windermere training, is you have to break it down. And I don't think that necessarily matters whether you're approaching your first, you might just be doing, and I don't use just lightly, but, you know, you might be trying to do your first 10K or even just a 5K swim. Whatever it is, the distance is almost irrelevant. But you have to break it down. I think if you start thinking about the full distance or the full duration, it becomes quite overwhelming. And you think, how can I possibly swim for 6 hours? Or how can I possibly swim 10 miles? And I can't think like that. I think one of the things that I very much took away from Windermere is not to think about the full distance, just to break it down. Because I can swim for half an hour, I can swim for an hour. So just keep doing that. Just keep swimming for half an hour, have something to eat, swim for half an hour, have something to eat. And that's all I do. And I think I, on some of my big weekends in July this year, as I was kind of ramping up for Loch Ness, they kind of saw me swimming. Saturday I'd do 6 hours, and then Sunday I'd be doing 6 hours as well. And there'd be moments when my brain would be thinking, I might be halfway in on the Saturday swim. So I've done 3 hours, I've still got three to go, and I've got to do it again on Sunday. And my brain would start saying things like, how can we possibly finish today's swim and we've got to do the same tomorrow? This, and then it just becomes very negative very quickly. It kind of have to, you know, listen to those voices, but at the same time kind of get rid of them as quickly as possible, because it will become overwhelming, it become too negative, and it will probably, it could become quite damaging to that particular event. You might not actually kind of complete the training. So I think it's, you have to break it down. And I didn't, you know, I obviously thought about the full distance of Loch Ness, so being 23 miles. I knew it was 23 miles because obviously you've got to train for that distance, but I didn't repeatedly tell myself that I'm swimming 23 miles. I didn't tell myself how long I was going to be swimming for. I just thought, I'm just going to break this down to half an hour. Every half an hour, I just need to look forward to, whatever drink and snack I'm going to get, and I'm going to keep going.
I've been writing down so many questions to put out of that, so I'm probably going to bounce around a little bit.
Yeah.
But just picking up that point there, then, so you are breaking things down, and you're not allowing yourself to really get carried away with the fact that you've got a significantly long way to go. 23 miles—that's a nice round number. It's almost 10 times an Ironman swim, for example. How do you deal with everyday people like me or the other person? And you're like, oh yeah, you swim. Oh, what kind of things do you swim? Oh, I swim, you know, these sort of distances. Like, when you're having those conversations, how do you allow yourself to have the conversation but not get carried away about the fact that it is a very, very long way? As a flip side, as a coach, I've always sort of said that I'm rarely shocked by people who say, hang on, you know, this is the race I'm planning for, because immediately as soon as they say that, I'm sat there trying to work out, okay, this is how you could train for it, and this would be how you, okay, fine, that's fine, I can understand it. So for me as a coach, I've rarely been caught kind of on the wrong foot, if you like, with saying that's a crazy idea, unless it's a very out there conversation with the athlete. Like, I was not expecting that to come out from your mouth, but never mind. This is how we could do it. How do you deal with the people who are asking you those questions, which are like, hang on, that is 23 miles. That's crazy. I don't even think I could walk that far or run that far. Or how they start focusing your mind onto the distance, because that's the only thing they can tangibly talk about.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good, good point. I think, I suppose this is probably what I've done without necessary kind of unconsciously sort of thinking. What I've probably done is, as part of, you know, kind of the whole thing, is normalize it. So, you know, well, there is an element to normalizing it, which obviously you can do, particularly within the sort of the community that might be doing very similar things or equally much bigger things. In a lot of cases, you know, that's there. There's lots of people that do all sorts of huge distances or, you know, huge challenges. I think the other thing is that what I've noticed after Loch Ness, because Loch Ness was a huge jump in a lot of respects, and I didn't actually have that comment from somebody, from going from Windermere, going up to Loch Ness. But I was okay with that because, you know, it was a decision that I'd made and I had advice from my coach and, you know, I was in the right place to be able to do that. And that's, you know, and it's also kind of understanding how you would jump from certain things. You know, you can't kind of always compare one discipline to another in terms of how you jump and how you train. You kind of have to look at them as individual in some cases. The one thing that I did to kind of answer your question is, I think from Loch Ness, is that I accept the fact that there will be people that think it's a ridiculous thing to do. And that's okay. Like, that's absolutely fine. And I think one of the thoughts I did have on Loch Ness was, I kind of agreed that it was, at times I thought, this is a ridiculous thing to do. This is a really long way to swim. It's going to take quite a long time. But then I also said, I'm absolutely fine with being ridiculous. I'm actually okay. I don't know. I will still continue to normalize it, because for me, that kind of makes these things not, I'm going to say the word smaller, but that doesn't mean smaller in the sense of not the achievement that they are, but just more manageable and not so overwhelming. But they are still ridiculous. And I'm actually started to come around to the fact that that's okay. I'm okay with that.
This ties you really nicely back into what you were discussing earlier. How much mind training or work have you done with anybody around psychology or kind of sports psychology or mental psychology, mental strength?
Yeah, I've actually done quite a bit, and it wasn't necessarily to start off with a swim, in like to talk about swimming as a focus. It was just generally sort of life coaching, if you like. Mm-hmm. But swimming is a huge part of my life, so obviously that was going to come up. And so, yeah, I've done quite a bit of work. And in particular, more recently, when I decided that I was going to do Loch Ness, I did have quite a lot of anxiety around whether I was fundamentally able to do it, because it was a huge ask. And also some of the kind of the fears and concerns about why I might not be able to do it, and sort of certain things that it was triggering. So one of my concerns for a very long time has been that I'm not particularly good in the cold. But then when I've spoken to, you know, some of my very good swimming friends who I've done a huge amount of swimming with, so the girls that I did my relay with, they would never say that. And actually Chloe, one of the four that I did the relay with, you know, she actually sort of said, well, you're very good in the cold. You love the cold as well. And I do. So my kind of perception of what I'm good at, or, you know, wasn't necessarily matching up with what other people were seeing. So I kind of had to do quite a bit of work on that. I think that was one of the kind of my fears of what I thought or perceived how I was doing with something wasn't necessarily stacking up to actually what I was able to do and wanted to do. So I've done a huge amount of work in terms of understanding the mental side of things. And, you know, I think with well, there's something that people will say a lot within marathon swimming, is that, yes, you need to be physically capable and able to be able to do it. But actually, there's a, you know, a much more significant part is actually comes down to being able to mentally do it. And I think that it's the mental aspect that will have a much bigger effect or impact on the success or the failure of an event. compared to the physical. And I think the physical is something that probably, you know, can apply yourself to the physical to a point, but it's the mental stuff that you really need to work on. But that's something that I've kind of felt very drawn to doing.
The reason I initially asked the question was because there's a lot of what you say resonates with the mindfulness acceptance commitment sort of theory. I don't know if you've come across that before or in its words, or if it's something you've actively done. You know, you're aware of the fact that what you're doing is a big distance, and that's okay. You have these voices which say you can't do it, and you don't ignore them. And I think a lot of times when people start out, especially in sport, or they start thinking about, oh, it must be mentally tough, it means I'm going to just ignore whatever mind send. You know, if my mind says you have to give up now, that's weakness, and they're going to smash it down and everything. And it's quite an aggressive way of looking at it. But actually, the way this strategy works essentially is by being very cognizant and being like, okay, that's fine. My body says I can't do this. That's what my little voice is saying. That's okay. It's just trying to tell me something useful. So now what else can I learn from that? And accepting it and then committing to something new. And I think you seem to be doing it very naturally with every bit of the conversation that you've done, and you're talking about it. It just flies out. And that's what I was asking. Have you been taught that skill, or is that something that you kind of done yourself?
I think there's two parts to it. So I think it's that I'm personally interested in it anyway. So I want to, I want to be able to understand myself better, but also how kind of the mind works and build mental sort of resilience. So there's an interest there. And also to be able to understand, actually, that's the bit that you kind of need to spend a huge amount of time on, because that will probably kill a swim over, you know, being ever so slightly undertrained from a physical point of view. But then also I have done quite a lot of work, with experts, or, you know, with people in, you know, being able to kind of understand how to deal with these things. And everybody will deal with them differently. I don't think it's one size fits all, which makes it, personally, I think that's very interesting. But yeah, you know, what you've said, it's not about squashing these voices. Something that I've learned over the years is that you have to, and this I think will unfortunately or fortunately come with experience, so it's not something that you can necessarily just do overnight or in a season, but understand the difference in those voices, because there will be certain voices that you really need to listen to and kind of understand what they're saying. And yes, we've got a pain or we've got an issue, but we just need to park that and get on with what we're doing. There'll be some voices that you probably do need to try and sort of close down relatively quickly because they're quite aggressive. And everyone will have their own, but, you know, there also are some voices that you really do need to listen to. You know, and I kind of reference winter open water swimming in particular. You know, there's certain voices that will always say we need to get out of the water, it's very cold, this isn't great, you know, blah, blah, blah. But then there's, for me, having done it for so long now, I know the difference between the voices that just want you to get out because it's not very comfortable to the voice that says, no, we're actually in danger now, we need to get out. So I think it's just being able to understand your own voices and what to do when they come up, and the different responses.
I'm sort of smiling to myself there a little bit, because I'm fairly certain that my voice would not be the one saying it's now cold, you should get out of the water. It'd be the one saying it's cold, don't go into the water. I think that's, as you say, it's an experience piece around understanding the different layers of those voices or the different types of those voices. And I guess that's a really interesting and obviously safety-based point, but you can get that within training, I guess, yourself. There's always, I think, when someone gets injured, unless it's an acute injury, you fall off your bike or you twist an ankle or something like that, for most of these repetitive endurance sports that we all decide to do and love, we probably knew we were going to pick up an injury that morning, the day or so beforehand. It's just we kind of didn't quite tune into the voice, the signal, the whatever it might have been, which we weren't really listening to. And actually, retrospectively, it's like, yeah, I knew I shouldn't have done that. And your ability to be able to dial into those different signals is so, so important. And you can see how, if you're open water in colder conditions, how critically important and actually, you know, significant it is in life and death situations, because it can be very dangerous. But it's an, I guess, from a not quite so serious perspective, trying to bring that into anybody's training is an important thing to be able to do. And aside from experience, how have you managed to distinguish between those? because the first time you go in, if your body's screaming at you saying to get out of the water, if you're saying, oh, there's two voices, one's a serious one, one's just telling you about it, how do you distinguish which one's which at the beginning?
Yeah, that's a good question. How do you distinguish? I think in my own experience, I think probably at the beginning it's harder just to distinguish between the different voices. And so with that, I think you then need to definitely err on the side of caution until you start to understand those voices more. And as you say, the layers or the tones or, you know, the how your voices kind of play out for you. And then I think this is, and I suppose it's kind of, I guess it probably just comes with experience, but then also an element of being able to trust yourself. So yes, your voices are probably going to be, well, particularly when you're swimming, your voices are going to be the loudest thing you hear because there is no other distraction. But also being able to trust yourself that despite what's happening in your head, you know, you will be able to make the right decision. And trust yourself that sometimes it might be that you do need to go slightly, you know, close to the edge, and you know what that looks like for you. And I think, as I said, sort of a few minutes ago, I think that it does just take time. It takes some experience. It takes doing it with people who kind of, you know, have some experience that they can share as well. And I think that, you know, doing it within a community as well, so that you know you've got kind of the safety aspect, but you could also talk to each other about sort of shared experiences and what works for others, and that might help you. And that's something that I've done a huge amount of over the years, is really listen to a lot of people, talk to a lot of people, because everybody has got, you know, something else to share, and that might be very helpful for you.
It reminds me of that quote, which is, if you're talking, then you're not learning. And if you're talking to other people and listening to them, then you're going to learn something from them as opposed to the way around, which is obviously useful if you're trying to take the next best idea from them. You seem to be exceptionally self-aware and very, very in tune with kind of what works for you, what doesn't work for you. How have you managed to build that awareness? I guess there's two parts to that question. One is, how have you managed to do it yourself? But then also, how have you managed to take on board information? You gave the example of, I'm not very good in the cold. And then you spoke to your teammates who said, Carmen, you're crazy. You are great in the cold. So clearly there's an internal and external part of that. But how have you got to that point of self-awareness? And how is it then useful for you?
Have I got to the point of self-awareness? To be honest with you, I don't really know how I've got to the point. I think it probably goes back to what I said previously, that I just, you know, I think that being self-aware, being able to kind of, you know, check in with yourself and kind of look at, you know, what you're doing. And I don't mean just in terms of being an athlete and, you know, you're kind of what you're doing from a sporting point of view, but just generally, you know, just to kind of learn more about yourself and how you deal with certain situations and why you might deal with certain situations, what triggers you, you know, all these, you know, because I think it, and probably for a long time I was probably separating my kind of day-to-day life or my life on land and then my swimming life, when actually it's just life, you know. And it's the same for probably work. I think that, you know, it might have been sort of before that you've got, you know, your work life and then you've got home life. But I think for me and probably a lot of people, we've kind of over the years seen a bit more of a blend, and it's life and it's you and it's how you show up, whether that's with your pool mates, whether that's with your colleagues, whether that's with your family. And I think being able to take any situation, be that something that happens at work or be that something that happens in the pool or elsewhere, and learn from it and then use that in another situation, I think just probably allows you to hopefully become you know, as self-aware as possible, but then also understand that it's just a continual evolving journey. There's no destination with it. It's just continually understanding yourself and how to deal with situations and kind of how to navigate life as best as possible.
How do you think that endurance aspect of your life then has spilled over into your life? It seems that, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems that you kind of almost kept the two sort of separate, and then now it's a fantastic cacophony of swimming and work and life and everything. So how do you see that as a positive and as a benefit? Because a lot of people say, you know, compartmentalize stuff and keep things at, you know, keep that thing at home and, you know, work stuff here and training stuff here. But you know, how do you see it complementing life?
So I think I probably first started to feel that, and it was quite a significant feeling, but after my channel relay. So after my channel relay, I kind of felt that that was one of the hardest things that I'd ever done. But also equally, so in equal measures, one of the best experiences of my life. And in a way, it put a lot of perspective on things. So it puts a lot of perspective onto life. You can feel very grateful and very fortunate that you are able to do things like that. But then also a lot of perspective on actually what is tough. And it's a choice. It was a choice to do it. So you kind of have to remind yourself of that as well. See, there's lots of things that we deal with in life that aren't choices. And so I think for me, what it probably started to do is just really kind of like build a trust that I have got resilience. So, you know, if I'm dealing with tough things, you know, outside of swimming, you know, the mental resilience or the mental toughness, if you like, that I've built from swimming, it's just part of me. It just comes with me. And it will, you know, it's just you. You don't necessarily need to kind of have them in different buckets or different segments for these situations. So I think I kind of had, you know, when I just shortly after I'd finished my or completed the relay, kind of like, I don't know, probably the following month I was starting a new job. It was quite a big job and it was quite a big change, but in a way it put a lot of perspective in, it gave me a lot of perspective because of what I'd achieved from the relay. So a lot of trust in myself that you can deal with tough stuff. It might not always be comfortable, and this job is going to be, you know, a lot of, you know, a lot of new learning, a lot of taking on different responsibilities and new responsibilities. But, you know, trust yourself that you can do it from the experiences that I had from swimming.
I think, again, just listening to how you were speaking, and I was obviously involved to a very small degree with a bit of your training and sort of seeing things. I saw a change as well from when you were with us in Oxfordshire to when you actually relocated down to the South Coast as well. How important was that geographical shift for you to sort of almost grow into kind of who you became? And how did that environment, training environment, the kind of life environment help as well?
I think that... I suppose because it was kind of my move down here was a fewfold. One, Brighton's always had a very special place in my heart. I went to university here, relatively close to most of my family, and also the new job that I was taking on just after the relay was based in London. So kind of, which would have meant that, you know, the journey from Brighton to London would have been a lot easier than Oxford. So kind of there was a number of different things that kind of fell into the mix for me wanting to relocate, but I think also it was I think something like I kind of after completing the relay and kind of not having really done a huge amount of sea swimming before the relay, so and obviously during relay training committing to going down to the sea as often as I could, it kind of sparked there was a huge interest in sea swimming, but then also there was still a big fear. And I think in a way it was the kind of the fear that attracted me just as much as enjoying being in the sea and wanting to be, I guess, more comfortable swimming in the sea and wanting to do something different. But I also think it's probably... maybe just having the confidence that from all the things that I've achieved, it might be different to the next person, but that doesn't mean that you haven't got kind of a place in that pool or a place in that lane or a place in that club or however you define it, it's that you're part of it. So I think probably my previous feelings of imposter syndrome from runner trying to become a swimmer, acknowledging that I am a swimmer and that not only do I love it, but, you know, I'm not bad at it, and just having the confidence. I think it's probably just comes down to having the confidence to say that, you know, I kind of deserve to be here and I can be here and I'm fortunate to be here and I'm going to give it my best shot.
Just to pick up then that point you said around the fear of the sea swimming, what was that fear for you?
I think it's just the vastness of the water. I think it's just the kind of the freedom as well. So, and also just the nature of this, I guess it's got all of a sudden you've got to kind of worry about like tides and currents and, you know, all things like that. I think when you go to most lakes, obviously if you're up in sort of, you know, areas like Lake District, it's obviously a bit different. But if you're going to kind of organised lakes, you've got very clear safety, you've got kind of people knowing that you're in and out of the water, you've potentially got canoes on the water, you've got a route that you follow. But when you're in the sea, you're kind of, you know, left to your own devices, you can just do whatever you want. So that can be quite daunting if you don't actually know what to do or how to do it safely. And then I think also it's just the, I guess you can start thinking that it's just the depth of the water and what might be in it, which doesn't necessarily, I don't think what's in it kind of that, I don't have that fear or had that fear. I think we're probably here in the UK, probably quite fortunate that we're generally okay. But it's probably just that it's a big body of water. You know, and sometimes, you know, and I think I've, probably actually from doing my relay, I've now just become incredibly comfortable and love just swimming where there's actually probably not much else. You know, you might just be swimming with a couple of mates, or, you know, the swims that I've done over the last couple of years, it's just you in a boat. And so now I really don't like being around a lot of people. I find that more terrifying than it just being you. So I think it's just different to obviously swimming in a very structured lake. But equally, there was an interest to be able to understand, you know, so how do I make this safe? You know, how do I understand tides and currents and where to swim and when to swim and that sort of thing?
I did actually have that as one of my kind of questions to ask you beforehand, was around that fear of open water, because I think a lot of people do have that. I mean, the number of times I've been coaching or offering, doing some level of open water based thing, and there's always a comment about you know, what's in the lake, the sea, whatever it might be, and that kind of fear of, I guess, the unknown, but almost the unknown of what's in there. And then the mind makes some pretty kind of big jumpy things. Clearly you don't have that because you swam across Loch Ness, where allegedly there's, I mean, they're searching at the moment. So did you see Nessie at all when you're swimming? But, you know, I guess there's also that aspect of your mind can, you, as you said, you don't have anything else to think about. You can't hear anything else. You've just got your thoughts. And so how do you help someone who, you know, has those thoughts going to the kind of the classic film of Jaws or squids or orcas or Nessies or whatever those jellyfish, those things are for you? That what's the kind of the technique that you've heard other people do, or is it anything you've had to do yourself as well?
Yeah, so I do. So, and I have had, those fears. You know, if kind of go back quite a number of years to the first swim that I did at Creamford Lakes in Oxford. It's so terrified. I didn't even want to put my head in it. You know, so, you know, I have had those fears, but I think, I think a lot of it will cut, like, I suppose, particularly for swimming, a lot of it will kind of come down to breathing and getting your breathing under control. Going into the situation, I think also going into the situation, but being calm. And I think also it's like, it's not to say that every now and again that I don't, or, you know, there's some situations that I do feel fear and I do feel scared. But how have I kind of dealt with it? I suppose it's probably just trying to sort of understand where that fear is coming from. And often they are quite irrational. But it probably goes back to what we were saying about voices. It's just being able to hear that voice, understand that it's slightly irrational. We're okay. And we know what we're doing. We're, you know, we've got our trusty boat next to us, or we've got our group of mates and they all know what they're doing and everyone's fine and, you know, we'll be okay. Or just kind of understanding where that fear will come from. And I think that when I did a few recce swims at Loch Ness, so before the event or before my swim kicked off, when I first got into the water, and I don't know if you're familiar with Loch Ness, but the water runs over peat, so it is black. And when I first got in, it was quite freaky. It was pretty freaky, actually. It kind of feels like you're swimming over a black hole. But also what's a bit different is that kind of associate it being, you think, because you can't really see it, or because it's black, you think that it's going to be because it's murky, which is pretty much the kind of how it feels when I'm swimming down here in Brighton. But it's not murky, it's very clear. So you can still see yourself very clearly, or you could see, you know, my friend that was swimming next to me very clearly. So that kind of does something to your mind as well. But I think it's just being able to understand that, you know, you have confidence and trust in yourself that, you know, you can do it. You're going to be okay. And just, again, listen to those voices, but understand how to kind of best control them.
It's interesting you're talking again about build those things up, break it down. You know, familiarize yourself with the environment and then you can go and do the thing. And it's just giving yourself the acceptance that those things will happen, but also allowing yourself the time to grow into that new space, which is, you know, really interesting to see. Obviously, there's that whole point when you get into the water for the first time, you don't just dive straight in again. That's just part of getting into cold water safely. But you're doing the same thing on a much bigger scale to a significantly longer swim as well. It's kind of almost familiarizing yourself with the environment again and again and again, so it becomes normal.
Yeah, and I think there's when I did my swim back from Rampion, which is a wind farm in Brighton, if I see jellyfish on a training swim, then I normally get a little bit freaked out. I will continue the swim, but I don't like jellyfish either. But it will have a greater effect on me if I see jellyfish, and this is in the UK, so our jellyfish are obviously very different to other parts of the world or other seas. But if I see a jellyfish on an event, there was some huge jellyfish on our swim in Rampion, I kind of get really annoyed and I think no jellyfish is going to stop this swim. So I kind of have a different sort of attitude to it if it's on an event compared to training.
I'm not a jellyfish fan when it comes to swimming. I have the kind of irrational fear that I'm going to take a breath and there's going to be a jellyfish over my mouth, which I always think would be like swallow a jellyfish, which would be nice. And then the other one, I always try and then condition it as a slightly more positive. It gives you more purchase in the water than water itself, so you can go faster and use them as kind of paddles to kind of get through. But that's fair enough. I'm not a jellyfish fan at all. So training for these events, you've done some great distances. Just quickly run through the distances so we get a feel for what they are, and then I'd love to know a little bit about what training looks like.
Yeah, so do you want me to start with English Channel, so obviously did that as a relay with three others, so we're a team of four, and that's 21 miles. Windermere was about 10.5, about 17k. Rampion was about 10 miles, and then Loch Ness was 23 miles.
I did not know that the Loch Ness was longer than the Channel.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I guess fewer tides and things to deal with.
And I think that when you start, it's kind of in an approximate area, you know, these swims of 20 something miles that kind of come into kind of that sort of category.
You really hope you swim straight then, don't you?
Yeah.
So obviously that's distance roughly, then what sort of time frames are we looking for that sort of swim ballpark?
So Windermere, I was 7.5 hours. Rampion, I was 5:15. Loch Ness, 14 hours 12. And as a team for our channel relay, we did 13.5 hours. Some pretty big distances, and they kind of take all day.
I guess then, so for the triathletes amongst us, you're kind of looking at half Ironman and Ironman, so durations really in the swims that you're doing. So what are the training, what does the training look like for you then for those events, aside from just swimming?
Yeah,
More detail than that.
Yeah, of course. So broken down to kind of work with the season. So during the winter, I would do a lot more pool work, and that's focusing on speed and technique. I still will swim throughout the year. So I will swim throughout a winter in skins, because whilst it's not necessarily hugely beneficial from a training point of view when it gets too cold, because you can't really do that much swimming, I like it. So during the winter, it's a huge amount of pool work, focusing on your technique, your speed. But then also one of the things that I did before Windermere, but I've come around to kind of probably doing it now for almost a year, probably slightly more than a year now, is committing to a strength and conditioning program, or sessions. So during the winter, I will take that up to 3 sessions a week. Then as my open water sessions get increasingly longer, that will go down to 2. And then when I'm in kind of a real intense period with swimming, which is probably for about a month to 6 weeks, it will probably go down to 1 session just for maintenance rather than build. And I think that has been one of the most significant things that I've probably done, on top of kind of the volume of swimming and the type of swimming I've been doing, because I think for a long time, and I've done a lot of work with a coach and a PT to be able to get to this point, but I think that for a long time, it's probably just thinking that whatever discipline you're doing, if you just do a lot of it, then you'll be successful. And that was definitely my headspace when I was a runner, which you can probably get away with when you're 20 something. But just being able to get stronger. And I think particularly if you're sea swimming, and see, I've got my English Channel solo next year, being able to get stronger will have a massive benefit when you're in, pretty choppy water. It's just fundamentally just keeping yourself stronger so you can hopefully keep, injuries and niggles at bay, has been really good. So really beneficial. As we go into sort of like spring and summer, then that's when my open water swimming kind of really starts to ramp up. So I increase, normally would train on time rather than distance. So I'd be doing a duration swim, kind of kicking off the spring, kind of trying to, staying in for sort of, getting up to 2 hours, and then just increasing that over a number of weeks, over a number of months. And I think what I found very interesting when I was doing my Windermere training, which was my first experience of training for such a long distance, was that one of my longest swims within my program that my coach and I were working on was a 3-hour. So getting to a continuous 3-hour point in skins. And I remember that swim vividly. My boyfriend, who's a huge support, was on the paddleboard with me, or next to me. And I was very nervous about that swim. I was very, very nervous about that swim. It was, longest swim on a weekend. But then what happens, which is quite interesting, and I think it all does come back to the mind, is that you then normalize and flip what was once a long swim to then that 3-hour swim, which was my long Sunday swim, becoming my midweek swim. And all of a sudden your long swims are 6 hours and beyond. And now a 3-hour swim, I think a 3-hour swim is just it's a fantastic difference. I kind of think 3-hour swim is like the equivalent of a half marathon. You need to put some effort in. You need to be relatively fit, but you can do it and it doesn't need to take over your whole life.
I think there's a lot to be said that. But you mentioned marathons. I was thinking both marathon and also Ironman training. You get to the point where the half distance is pretty much your normal, your midweek training session. You're training for an Ironman, you go for a 2-3 hour ride, you will have done that 75, 80, 90, 100 kilometers. It's like, this is great. This is just like part of training. So you're absolutely right there. But I think, 14 hour swims make your 7-hour midweek swims a little bit harder to fit in.
Yeah. And I think also one of the things that you do for swim training is you do back-to-back weekends, and you probably do this in lots of other sports as well, is that kind of, I guess, training on being tired, but that just repetitive nature to the training. So during July, I had a lot of weekends where it was, you know, 6 hours, you know, 6 hours Saturday, 6 hours Sunday. That would drop down a bit to maybe four the following week. So you kind of, you know, you're loading correctly, and then you pick it back up and you do another 6 hours, another 5 hours. And so, yeah, I think you have some pretty big weekends like that where, you know, there is a lot of training. But I think the other thing that I do is, in addition to my strength and conditioning, but I also do a lot of yoga. So probably try and do during sort of very big swim months, I could probably do about two or three sessions a week. But during kind of an off season, or as I go into the winter, I could probably a happy place is kind of four sessions a week. And I think that whilst there's certain things that I really can't do anymore because despite a certain mobility, I just, you know, haven't got the mobility in my shoulders that I used to have. But I think if I didn't do it, I don't think I'd be able to move. I think it's just laying on different things within your training rather than just doing the one thing, the one discipline that you're training for, but having different things around it to support it.
So are you swimming, what, 6 days a week, every day?
Not swim every day, but I would be swimming at the moment probably like 4 or 5 times a week, and then during kind of intense months I'd be swimming, there'd be days when I'd be swimming twice a day.
Nice. So how do you manage nutrition in the race itself? Because unlike when you're on a bike, you can't just reach out and grab a bottle and go, and you can't carry it. I guess you could carry a gel or two, but how does the nutrition work on one of those longer distance races? Sorry.
I've done a huge amount of work with a nutritionist as well to be able to understand, you know, what I need, and then also work out the logistics of being able to get that. On what we would call a feed in the swimming world. And I get asked this question quite a lot, actually, because I think people are quite interested in terms of what you can eat. You can generally eat whatever you want, really. You know, I think that you could probably say that to everyone. But generally speaking, the way it would work is that you'd have, you know, you can decide how often you feed. I do probably what's quite typical to most is I would, on a long swim, I would have something after an hour, and then I'd have something every half an hour from that point on. And you're normally basically just, you're thrown a bottle, which will be on if my boyfriend's on a paddle board, he would just throw the bottle to me and then come and collect it, or I throw it back, which has had a few disasters, but, you know, I've avoided hitting each other on the head. And then if you're on a boat, then it's attached to a rope, and you kind of throw in the bottle, and then, you know, they'll just pull the rope back in. And I think what I like is that everybody has, all the people that I've spoken to, everybody is having slightly different things. And I think sometimes it can be quite obscure, but also just be the things that you're going to look forward to. And I think that's one of the things that I learned, is that you just really have to be able to look forward to the thing that you're going to be thrown, because that is probably what's going to keep you going for another half an hour. So whether that's, for me, it's marshmallows, lemon drizzle cake, peaches, hot chocolate, find the things that are nutritionally going to give you what you need. So it is a lot of sugar, or things like maltodextrin, fructose, stuff like that. But yeah, it's the things that you also taste and emotion-wise really will look forward to.
How do you throw a lemon drizzle cake? Sorry.
Yeah, it's all kind of a bit. You have sort of like little pots that are tied to, you can like with clips, and you just get thrown a pot. So this stuff isn't bone dry, I'll be honest. It sometimes is a little bit soggy, but to be honest with you, you really don't care.
To be fair, a moist lemon drizzle cake is better than a dry one anyway.
Yeah, so. you don't really care.
Yeah, definitely. Interesting, very interesting. I definitely don't want to go down the whole how many grams and everything else are you taking, because as you say, that's very individual and everyone's different. But it's just interesting to hear kind of how you manage that, as you say, the logistics off that side of things. You talk a lot around... or at least when we've spoken before, around commitment to a process, but also enjoying the process almost as much or more than the actual event itself. And I guess, I mean, why is that so important for you to kind of give that message to people?
I think it's important because the process is something that's going to take probably quite a long time. You know, be that, you know, if you think my process to get to in the channel, I think, you know, it's looking on sort of like 4 years. But even if you're just talking about a process within a training season, you know, we're talking weeks and months. So I think, you know, I really love the process. I really love being able to understand the different elements to it and the different parts to it and taking yourself on that journey, reflecting back on, you know, on the sessions within that, you know, within that training block, but also looking back at, you know, ones from previous and learning from it. So I think the process is going to take a lot longer than the event itself. And I think if you're not fully invested and behind the time and the commitment to the process, then, you know, you have to really want this stuff. You know, I think one of the things that definitely came up for me in Loch Ness was that you really, really have to want it. You have to really, really want it. And that comes from really committing yourself to the months or the weeks and the months and the years to be able to get to that point. And I think if you don't, I feel like that's a little bit of a shame because I think the process can be just as enjoyable as the event itself.
I'm so pleased as a coach that you said that you focus on the process, because that is coaching to athlete 101 here. Look, let's focus on the process. The outcome will take care of itself. That might have then made my next question slightly superfluous, but how close have you been to the edge of actually not being able to do one of these events or something you put your mind to? Either mentally, physically, emotionally. Cold temperature, I guess, comes into it as well.
I'd probably say I got relatively close to with Windermere. So I signed up for Windermere. Encouragement from my dear friend Chloe, quite some time, probably about a year before Windermere. So I kind of thought, well, I'd got enough time to figure this out. And as the months went on, I just felt that I was getting quite overwhelmed with how I was actually going to be able to train for it and what I actually needed to be able to do. And I probably spent quite a few weeks before it got to a point where I needed to train, but probably, you know, just discussing it with my boyfriend, with friends, that I don't think I can do it, you know, and sort of thinking I'm going to have to pull out of this. But what I find quite interesting with me is that there's often just a very quiet voice that wants to do it. We might not have figured out any of the details and how we're going to do it and what that process looks like, but we want to do it. And that's the voice that stops me from not going ahead and finding out what I need to do, speaking to a coach, etc. And that's the voice that, you know, stops me sort of sending an email to cancel. That's the voice that gets me to do it.
Interesting. Carmen, thank you very much for that. We're just going to move on now. We've got a few kind of quick fire questions you'd like to ask people at the end, just to sort of see where we're at. So first up, keep it brief, kind of sentence maximum kind of thing. But what does believe, strive, achieve mean to you, and how is it applied to your experiences?
What does it mean to me? I would say, believe in yourself, right? Believe in yourself, have trust in yourself, and you know, want what you're setting out to do. Really want it. Don't want it for other people, or want it because you think other people might want you to do it. You have to want it. And I think that, like you said, you know, that's probably what we'll see the results happen. You know, the wanting it and the, you know, applying yourself to it.
What would be a measure for you of a good coach or good coaching practice?
Trust. So it comes down to trust.
What is your favourite race, or what would be your bucket list event that you'd like to do? You've already got the channel in there, so I don't know if that's...
Yeah, I've got a channel in there. One of the things, I haven't actually, I haven't told my mum this, so I probably need to soon before she listens to this, because I did promise her I'd never do a two-way. But after doing Rampion one way, so my friend Chloe swam out and I swam back, it was so much fun. Okay, there were still some really tough moments, but it was just a really fun swim. It might not be next time, but I would quite like to do two-way Rampion.
What's been your best sporting memory so far?
It's best sporting memory so far. It's quite difficult because I think finishing Loch Ness was pretty awesome. I think probably a big turning point for me was finishing Windermere, having gone through quite a lot of anxiety before about whether I was actually going to be able to do it. It was a huge swim for me at the time, still is. But finishing Windermere on my birthday was pretty awesome.
That is, it's a good time. Good job you have a summer birthday, otherwise it could be a cold. Carmen, thank you very much for joining us on the Believe, Strive, Achieve Endurance podcast. I think this has been a fantastic insight to the endurance mindset, and thank you very much for being so candid and sharing your experiences with everybody.
Yeah, thanks, Philip. Thanks for the conversation.
So, Philip, what a fantastic episode we had here with Carmen. It was very good to see how someone that came from running went to long-distance swimming. I have my own thoughts about this episode. I would like to hear it from you. What was your main thing that you can take out of it?
Yeah, it was really fascinating, wasn't it? I think the first thing, I guess jokingly, I found really interesting was that Loch Ness is actually a bigger distance swim than the Channel swim, because everyone talks about the Channel as being one of those really hard things. And I guess in terms of distance, I had no idea that Loch Ness was longer. So that's a good bit of trivia, which I'm going to keep for a pub quiz or something like that. But on a more serious point, I think it was really, really interesting listening to what Carmen had to say and link that back to the conversation that we had with Mark Harvey around the Decker Ironman and the idea that you just have to break it down. That was an obvious, really clear takeaway that I think any athlete would be wise to take on. And as is seen by people doing extraordinary distances, and for them, it's extraordinary distances for pretty much everybody, but clearly for other people, it might just be doing the local 5K. You know, it doesn't matter what that big distance is. You just break it down and you break it down and eventually you realize you've gone, you know, 23, 24 miles of swimming, which is just crazy for the average person. But you keep on breaking things down, you're going to keep on building. And I think that's a really cool takeaway for anyone in endurance sport at any distance and any level.
I think for me, the most interesting part is how someone that is afraid of swimming in, I wouldn't say afraid, but has her own fears of swimming in open water swimming, goes for very long distances in open water. So the mindset and the work you had to do to change that when you have to race and we have to do these challenges, it's impressive. I was remembering the story about the jellyfish. To be honest with you, I'm terrified of jellyfish. And if I see one in the water, I just don't go in at all. So swimming, I don't know, 20, 30 miles with jellyfish is not for me. And I don't know if I would be strong enough to change my mindset for that. But the way she did it was impressive.
Yeah, I think for me, that was the, I guess, surprise of the talk we had, because I was not expecting the conversation to go down quite such a deep psychological or mental area. And it was really clear that Carmen had a very, very significantly higher than average self-awareness. She was super aware of herself, her abilities, maybe detrimentally. Obviously, we talked around the idea that her friend said, but you're great in cold water. But her awareness has meant that she's really been able to take any improvement points any time through coaching or her own abilities or planning, and being able to better herself at every single step. And we there's talk around marginal gains and the idea of 1% improvements and things like that, which are quite commonplace. And she's basically taken that approach, but put that into her own mindset and then applied it to the sport that she's chosen. And that's a big part about why she's managed to succeed to the level that she's succeeded and make such significant changes and improving every single time. It's because of that self-awareness. And that's where her, if you like, the mental toughness and mental strength comes. It's because she's aware of where her strengths and weaknesses lie, what she needs to do, what she feels like, listens to that, and then betters herself. And it was shown again with some of the situations that she was talking about with the inner voice, where she's sort of listening to the things which she needs to hear, and then filtering out the noise and focusing on the important stuff, be that cold water or anything around how she's feeling, or, you know, I feel a bit tired, I don't think this is quite good. You know, she's picking up, and that self-awareness again, picking up the really, really important bits and the things that she can discard. And it might be that athletes are getting better at doing that at a psychological level, like Carmen, or even just all your friends and everything talking about how great you're going to do in a race or something like that, where we can get distractions. And those are not necessarily inner voices, but they're external voices. And you can take those and just be like, hey, look, ignore that. And focus on the really important things, be that the key voices like a coach or people who know you better or yourself.
Would you say that is the main lesson that the listeners can take from this episode, is listen to what is important and filter?
Oh, I think there's so many great lessons in there. I think it does come around that piece of self-awareness and listening. I think you're right, listening is a really, really important thing. But it's listening to it, with a very deliberate approach. So it's not just kind of hearing these things and saying I can't do it, jellyfish out. It's actually listening to everything and taking it all on board based on the situation. So it's like a 360 degree listen, as opposed to just listening or hearing.
I agree. Anyway, thank you so much. This was a very good one, and looking forward to the next one.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for your time, Diego.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The Believe, Strive, Achieve podcast is produced every week for your enjoyment, and show notes are found at trytrainingharder.com. Come back often and feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Try Training Harder. Thanks for listening.